My name is Sandra Berry, and I'm the director of Woodbrook Quaker Study Centre in Birmingham. It is usual for the Swarthmore Lecturer to be introduced by the previous year's lecturer, and I am not him. The 2010 Swarthmore Lecturer was given by Paul Lacey. Paul is based in the US, and unfortunately, he is prevented from joining us this year, although I know he will be upholding the events this evening. As Paul is unable to be with us in person, the Swarthmore Lecture Committee have asked me to make this introduction. I will confess, friends, that the first Swarthmore Lecture that I heard, I had absolutely no idea that it was connected to Woodbrook in any way. I hope you are reassured that, as I have been director at Woodbrook since November last year, that I now know that it is much more than just connected to Woodbrook, but actually a significant part of Woodbrook's educational programme. Whilst it is unfortunate that Paul Lacey cannot be with us this evening, I'm very grateful that it gives me an opportunity to introduce the 2011 lecture. The Swarthmore Lectureship was established by the Woodbrook Extension Committee in 1907. The committee's minute recorded that the lectureship should provide for an annual lecture on some subject relating to the message and the work of the Society of Friends. The name Swarthmore was chosen in memory of the home of Margaret Fox, which was always open to the earnest seeker after truth, and from which loving words of sympathy and substantial material help were also given. The lectureship has a twofold purpose. First, to interpret to the members of the Religious Society of Friends their message and their mission. Second, to bring before the public the spirit, aims, and fundamental principles of Friends. The lecturer alone is responsible for any opinions expressed. You'll be pleased to know that copies of the book of the lecture will be on sale in the Quaker Bookshop this evening. And you can also order an audio recording of tonight's spoken lecture from the Woodbrook stall inside the gathering tent. There will be a follow-on worship sharing session with this evening's Swarthmore lecturer, held tomorrow, that's Tuesday evening, 7:30 in Grimmond LT3. Tonight's lecturer is Pam Lunn. Pam joined the staff of Woodbrook in January 1989, following a scientific education and a varied career in a range of educational settings. After several different roles at Woodbrook over the years, she and Liz Rowe generated a plan for a sustainability education programme, which became known as Good Lives. This programme has been running since 2008, and tonight's lecture draws upon it. The lecture this evening will, as is our practice, be conducted in a spirit of worship, and it is set in silence. When Pam has finished speaking, she will sit, and it is not our practice to applaud at the end, but instead to sit together and reflect in silence for a few moments. Pam and I will then shake hands, indicating the end of the session. We will now settle, and Pam will begin speaking when she is ready.
Thank you so much for coming and sitting in here on such a hot, sweltering night. And thank you also for all the thinking and sharing that's been going on the theme of sustainability over the last, it is only 2 days, both in here and all around the campus in workshops. It's quite unusual for a Swarthmore lecture to be as integrated into the subject matter of a gathering as this one is. So I'm immensely grateful for all the engaging with the issue that's been going on already. My title for this lecture, as well as for the book that accompanies it, is Costing Not Less Than Everything: Sustainability and Spirituality in Challenging Times. And during the lecture, I'll follow the shape of the chapters in the book. Only One Earth. What kind of community? What does a good life look like? How long is sustainable? We're all crew. The time is now. So I start with the fundamental truth that we have only one Earth. This image from the 1968 Apollo moon mission shows a gibbous Earth hanging low in the sky above a barren moon surface. It's known as Earthrise. In 1980, the astronomer Carl Sagan gave it the caption, "The home planet of an emerging technical civilization struggling to avoid self-destruction." This was the first of the famous photographs of the Earth from space. But arguably the most influential image to come out of the whole of the US space program was the one sent back by Apollo 17 4 years later. This image shows the whole disk of the Earth, with the oceans either side of the African continent and a swirl of white cloud above. It's known as the Blue Marble. And it came to be the most widely reproduced image in all history. It was used by environmental campaigning groups, by commercial organizations, in advertisements, on book covers, and on stickers, postcards, and more. This view of the world, alone in the blackness of space, touched something deep in many, many people. The photograph was widely sold as a postcard with the one-word caption, "Home," and on another one with the words, "Love your mother." The power of such an image, the idea that it would foster if it ever became available, had been predicted as far back as 1950. That idea was, of course, in essence, about the unity of Earth and of life on Earth. Blue marble was the most used, but it was the Earthrise image that was the first one we ever saw. And Al Gore credited it with starting the whole environmental movement. It's estimated that about 2 billion people, that's half the population of the world then, watched the TV transmissions of that 1968 Christmas Eve moonshot. And the sequence of events that followed bear out Al Gore's suggestion. Friends of the Earth was founded in 1969. The first Earth Day in the USA was 1970, and Greenpeace was founded in 1971, along with a host of other less well-known initiatives all the way around the world. The decade-long Apollo program was the largest and most expensive undertaking in the whole of human history that wasn't about waging war. Looking back now, the lessons and emotions of that time flow into our current concerns about climate change and other environmental threats that have magnified since then. Recalling what was stirred in many people at that time, including those professed as non-religious, we need to take with utter seriousness the place of theology, religion, and spirituality as necessary to our human response to the challenges now facing us. People of faith, of all faiths, have a crucial role to play. Our sense of the oneness of Earth can now be reinforced by developments that have occurred since the time of the space missions in a completely other area of science, genetics. The study of something called mitochondrial DNA shows that the genetic heritage of humanity retains only one female lineage, surviving from our earliest ancestors to us now, sometimes called mitochondrial Eve. There is only one Earth and only one family. We are indeed all cousins. And in fact, we might look to cultures other than our own that reckon family relationships differently, and where relations whom we call cousins would be called brothers and sisters. We are all truly one family. We are all truly brothers and sisters, not just ideologically or spiritually, but in our flesh and in our bones, we are family. Of course, further back than humanity, we're kin to all life on Earth through the process of evolution. It really is the case that there's a tree of life. That's one tree, not a forest. We're deeply connected to the whole chain of living beings, even down to the level of our biochemistry. As friends, we would perhaps turn first to our spirituality as a response to the majestic scale of what confronts us. But we shouldn't underestimate the place of theology in creating frameworks and meaning and purpose that can inspire and move us to action. A significant consequence of a theistic religion is the sense of human dependence. We didn't make this earth. We don't sustain it. We don't own it. Which brings us to the issue of community. What we somehow have to rediscover, we as the whole human community, is that the earth is not ours to dispose of as we wish. Even if people can't subscribe to a belief that the earth is the Lord's, there are other ways of seeing that we're not the owners. We're merely tenants passing through with the responsibility of a full repairing lease on the premises and borrowing everything that we use. We're the current stewards of the earth, and we urgently, very urgently, need to start being good stewards. You'll know the saying that we don't inherit the earth from our ancestors, but rather we borrow it from our children and their children's children. We're currently borrowing more than we can pay back, And it's not only about our carbon emissions. Earth Overshoot Day is the point in the year when we've used up as much of the Earth's total resources as the Earth can regenerate in a year. Since the late 1980s, we've been going into eco-deficit each year, progressively degrading the environment, with the overshoot day arriving a little earlier each year. In 2010, the moment was estimated to be the 21st of August. The final calculations for this year, 2011, aren't yet available, but it's looking as though it might be a little bit later. A tiny shred of hope generated by the global economic downturn, reinforcing what we know, that the fundamental problem is our ever-increasing consumption. The sense of one vast human community, 6.7 billion now, compared with about 4 billion during the Apollo missions, may act as a focal point or motivator for some people. But for most of us, our actual sense of community is much closer to home. And as the effects of climate change and peak oil start to impact significantly on our own local lives, we'll need to rely much more on our immediate community, and indeed starting to do that now, before we're forced to, is one of the ways of reducing carbon emissions caused by the transportation of both goods and people. It also gets us used to new ways of doing things. It's good practice. For an increasing number of people, there's a deep sense of recognition that a good life, good in material, ethical, and spiritual ways, is very far removed from the average Western lifestyle, and that fundamentally it has some kind of community at its core. Such a community, enabling real belonging, has to be based on reserves of trust, mutuality, and unselfishness. Trust that one isn't alone, trust that there are others who'll help to make life possible. In our individualized, materialistic Western lives, those qualities are fast fading from the norms of everyday life. One thing we do know, for sure, is that creating and living in community isn't easy. For instance, in the Rule of St. Benedict, chapter 70 is titled, "That no one presume to strike another unlawfully." It's always instructive to notice what's forbidden by any institution, whether religious or secular. The fact that someone has taken the trouble to forbid something is a sure sign that it's happening, and perhaps often. Of course, community isn't limited to intentional residential community. In the religious context, there's a long history of the local church congregation being community for its members in many ways, including at its best spiritual nurture, practical help, human fellowship, and common purpose. And for much of Quaker history, this has been a significant dimension to the life and organization of the Society of Friends. Indeed, in Quaker Faith and Practice, chapter 10 is titled "Belonging to a Quaker Meeting," and the first subheading is "Our Community," a section containing 20 extracts. The fact that the next subheading is "Conflict Within the Meeting" tells us something else important about community, as does the fact that this section only has 4 entries. It's not a matter that we find easy to deal with. This isn't so much about a need for conflict resolution as about finding together the deep grounding of our commonality, something deeper than mere agreement. In many of our local meetings today, there's a concern about the meeting as community and how that sense may be fostered. Newcomers among us often speak of finding friends as a kind of coming home. And it's vital that we foster our capacity to welcome and include those who seek us out, as well as finding ways of making ourselves more accessible to those who might have assumed our way isn't for them. One of the dilemmas about being welcoming to newcomers and about being community for and with each other in our local meetings is finding the right balance between aloneness and togetherness. Quakers as a group, for many reasons, have a higher proportion of introverts than is the case in the surrounding society. So a particular challenge for us, and perhaps therefore a gift that we may have to offer to others, is how to create community that works for introverts. As friends, we may find that the fruits of our exploration into creating and sustaining community in our meetings could become a resource for others in our local area as we discover together how to move towards a lower carbon way of living. Some of our Quaker processes and practices are so familiar to us, so taken for granted, that we can forget how precious, powerful, and significant they are. If we're true to our Quaker principles and practice, true to our leadings, true to what we're capable of being at our best, we have a gift that we can offer to the wider world in an era of growing need. While there are some friends involved in creating forms of intentional community, living together in some form of shared housing, for the vast majority of us, our community will be forged from the locality where we happen to find ourselves living. And community does have to be created. It doesn't just happen by virtue of living in close proximity to one another. Much of transition town activity, for instance, whilst being stimulated by the challenges of peak oil, climate change, and energy descent, is actually directed to the recreation of local community in terms of both practical activities together and enhanced relationships. And of course, it's often the case that undertaking a significant task together is a deeply effective way of building community relationships. We also need to start thinking about what kind of national community we want to be here in Britain. The current estimates of how a warming climate will affect these islands suggest that we'll fare relatively well compared with many parts of the world. We'll be neither drowned nor drought-stricken. This will make us, along with some other particular places in the world, one of the attractive destinations for the slow but inexorable stream of climate refugees from all over the globe. We'll become one of the lifeboats. But we're already a crowded island. If we had to be self-sufficient because of disrupted international trade, we don't have enough land and fishing grounds to feed our present population, let alone a vastly increased one. Friends have a history of concern for refugees and asylum seekers. That concern projected forwards implies that we should start now to prepare a response to the popular and political voices that will certainly be raised in antagonism to the needs of those beyond our shores. This will be a very difficult dilemma. Do we turn people away in order to preserve the life and health of those already here? Or do we take people in? And if the latter, how do we feed a growing population on a small landmass? If we take in some people but not all, how do we make those decisions? While these problems are not yet pressing upon us, we need to start now, in this relatively peaceful and non-urgent time, to think long-term about this aspect of our future. As friends, we need to have confidence in our history on these matters, in our ability to influence and to speak truth to power. Considering the aspirations of any form of intentional community or enhanced local neighbourhood can tell us something about our dreams for the kind of life we would like to be living. What does a good life look like? Our cultural roots offer many prescriptions for what the good life might consist of, and some of them resonate with our current ecological concerns. Some 3,500 years ago, for instance, Moses gave the Israelites what we now call the Ten Commandments. In our 21st century times of environmental awareness, not coveting our neighbour's goods takes on a modern twist as a commandment against consumerism. Our Quaker testimony to simplicity can lull us into thinking that we know all about this. But living in a rich country, our calibration of what simple consists of is a very, very long way from the global average. If we're to be truthful about our witness to simplicity, we have a long way to go. We've become accustomed to thinking about peak oil and our carbon footprint. But these are only a beginning. Our next focus should be on peak water and our water footprints. Beyond water, peak wood, peak food, peak phosphate, and peak soil all require attention. Reduced availability of fossil fuels, water, and good land all impact on food production. Food insecurity is something we'll be hearing about with greater frequency and urgency. The concept of eco-justice hasn't yet made its way into the mainstream public conversation about the environment. And friends may need to consider how our voice should be raised on that concern. Every reduction or saving of resources that we undertake here is an act of solidarity with the poorest people living in the developing world whose lives are already being worsened by climate impacts. The dimension of what we might term generational justice has barely been heard yet. And this is a theme I'll return to later, but suffice it to say here that those of us born in the industrialized world in the middle portion of the 20th century have, as a generational and geographical cohort, lived with more than our fair share of even the rich world's resources. There are other areas where friends have a track record of concern and action from which we might be able to bring time-honored concepts to bear upon the current environmental situation. For instance, arising out of our long-standing concern and work in the field of criminal justice, can we bring models of restorative justice into the climate debate? In this case, the victims are both the environment itself and poor people in parts of the world already most devastated by the effects of climate change. The tragedy currently unfolding in the Horn of Africa is a warning on many levels: climate, politics, both global and local, economics, and armed conflict. What might restorative climate justice look like on a global scale? Another example would be responsibility to protect, known as R2P, which was discussed by Paul Lacey in last year's Swarthmore Lecture. R2P currently focuses on preventing and halting four crimes: genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. Building on our history of support for and work with the United Nations, might we initiate a movement to add to this list crimes against the environment? The changes required of all of us, the demands that will be made on humanity over the next 30 to 50 years are enormous. A few people and communities have started to grasp the magnitude of this, but collectively, as nations, as political entities, we haven't even taken the first step. Beyond recycling, beyond changing our light bulbs, beyond doing our bit, lies the biggest challenge of humanity's entire history. This isn't about guilt, and it isn't a matter for self-laceration. It requires intelligence, imagination, and cooperation from everyone. For those of us starting from a faith commitment, it requires reorientation towards the inward springs that nourish outer action. For friends specifically, we must revitalize what testimony really means. A powerful outflowing from the depths of our spiritual experience, because we are impelled, because we can do no other. That's what testimony is, not a list of things we believe in. How do we become the change we want to see? How do we motivate ourselves and others to do what we know is needed? How do we, as a community of friends, as a religious body, become beacons, patterns, and examples? Alongside members of other religious groups, we have deeply held views about the nature of human beings. We also believe that the best can be elicited from people, given love and the right circumstances. We need to be more bold in our beliefs, in the face of what can often seem to be an indifferent and cynical world. If our good life flows out of our love of life, our compassion, our joy, then it will touch others. If we love the earth, we reduce our consumption and our waste because it's truly a joyful thing to do, not a grim, guilty necessity. A good life can't be for ourselves alone, but flows out of a love that embraces the whole of life on earth, past, present, and imagined future. Which brings us, of course, to sustainability. How long is sustainable? Cosmologist Brian Swimmer said this: "It's really simple. Here's the whole story in one line. This is the greatest discovery of the scientific enterprise. You take hydrogen gas and you leave it alone. And it turns into rose bushes, giraffes, and humans. The point is that you leave it alone for a very, very, very long time. We have great difficulty in imagining even much shorter time spans than this. If the human habitation on this earth is to become sustainable in reality, we have to use our imaginations and expand our time horizons We have to believe, really believe, that the far distant future will be real. And then act in such a way that it will remain broadly bio-friendly and not just deceptively people-friendly in the short term. Some years ago, as the millennium approached, you may remember, there was a public consultation in Britain to discover what people felt would be appropriate commemorative projects. And there was an overwhelming surge of public support for tree planting. To plant a tree is to believe in a future, maybe 100, maybe 1,000 years hence. To plant a tree is to be hopeful, not in the sense of casual optimism, but hope as an act of will, a choice to take a certain attitude to the future. And trees can tell us something about that vexed term, sustainability. It's an abstract word, difficult to get a grip on, in any way that means something real to us. But it's actually quite simple. If we all carry on doing what we're doing now forever, will that work? Well, of course it won't. But to make forever real to us, we need to enlarge our sense of time, and trees help us to do that. The oldest trees we know of are more than 3,000 years old. They date back to what we call the Iron Age. We need these images to help us comprehend these long timescales, because tangible images of a long past may help us to start imagining a long future. And as we take that long look into the future, we start, of course, from where we are now, a physical and social world that has already been deeply shaped by the forces of industrialization, mechanization, mass production, and consumption. But also a social world in which the real costs of this are only now becoming truly understood. Early friends believed that they were living in the end times, and the second coming would occur in their lifetimes. And so everything about how to live, about choices and priorities, was shaped by that. As time went by, and it became clear this wasn't actually happening, there began a slow adaptation to living in the meantime. As an old cartoon has it, the end is not near, you must learn to cope. The present environmental crisis is often portrayed in apocalyptic terms. Is humanity facing another kind of end time? What kind of spiritual resources are required of us? What kind of response needs to be called from us? I think we need a combination of now and eternity, or now and forever. Like that old country saying that says, live your life as if you'll die tomorrow, but farm your land as if you'll live forever. The greatest barrier to making effective changes in our behaviour towards a more sustainable way of living is the hugely powerful force of habit, which should never be underestimated. The extraordinary proportion of our lives that are run by our autopilot. Buddhism teaches that our habitual way of existing is like being asleep, and we need to wake up. And the way to do this is the practice of mindfulness along with the cultivation of compassion. If you seek to practice mindfulness or awareness, then everything, every action, every moment, every situation can be regarded as an occasion of practice. given that our governments aren't going to take sufficient action sufficiently quickly on climate change, and given a worsening global economic environment, we're all going to face failures of our infrastructure and interruptions to our normal supplies of energy, food, goods, and services. So when temporary glitches start to happen now, treat it as practice. That's practice in the usual sense of rehearsal, get used to it, get used to handling it and being resourceful, but also practice as a personal mental discipline, leading to equanimity in the face of irritations or worse. Actually, some of us had an opportunity to practice this on the way here on Saturday, when we discovered there were no trains on the West Coast line running in or out of Euston. A number of us here had a great opportunity to practice. We can treat everything, everything, as practice. For all the changes that are ahead of us, we need to be prepared, we need to be practiced, and the practice we need is spiritual, psychological, emotional, and very, very practical. Marshall McLuhan is reported to have said, "There are no passengers on spaceship Earth. We're all crew." In the current environmental crisis, and I don't say coming crisis because it's already with us, there's no space for passengers. We all have to take responsibility. And if we're all crew, then we all need to be well informed and trained. Just as among unprogrammed friends, our commitment to the priesthood of all believers means that we each have to offer gifts, talents, ministry in many forms, leadership, and seriousness of purpose. So what's needed to turn passengers into crew? There's a substantial field of research into human behavior in emergencies that goes under the name of bystander intervention or bystander apathy. If I'm a bystander to some emergency event, I have to make a series of decisions about whether or not I'll step forward to intervene. First, I have to notice that something is happening. Then, interpret it as needing intervention. Then I have to decide if I have a responsibility to act, and if so, what form that should take. Should I try to help directly, or should I call the emergency services? This research applies to perceived emergencies. And although the current environmental crisis actually is an emergency, it's what one writer calls a long emergency, which makes it quite hard for people to perceive it as such. But let's bring this field of research specifically to the subject of climate change and apply the five steps of the bystander process. Notice that climate change is a problem. Interpret this as a situation in which something needs doing. Assume personal responsibility for doing something. Choose what to do. Implement that. Well, it's clear that climate change is a problem. That one's already been noticed. And it's clear that something must be done. Those are the easy steps. The critical third step is that we, each and all of us, take responsibility for doing something. There are many, many, many reasons for not doing something. Whereas the one valid reason for doing something is that it's the right thing to do. And one of the common factors found among the bystanders who intervened, who assumed responsibility in the situation they found themselves, was the strong belief that what you do or fail to do does actually make a difference. It matters what choices we make. Perhaps even more pointed in our current situation is James Hansen's advice. Hansen, a senior scientist in NASA, was the first person who said that the ice caps would respond quickly to global warming, and he was right. His stark message in his most recent book may be summed up as this: the situation is worse than we're being told, your governments are lying to you, nothing is being done, you can't compromise with nature and the laws of physics, consequently, it's up to you. Civil resistance may be the only way forward. If it's up to us, what might that mean in practice? To start with, it means all those things that we already know about, but may not yet have fully implemented in our own lives. Insulate our houses, use less gas and electricity, reduce our travelling, change our means of travel, eat less meat or none at all, reduce all consumption and waste, reuse, repair, and recycle everything we can, shop less, shop local, reduce food miles, grow your own, compost food waste, buy without packaging, cook fresh food from scratch, and so on, and so on, and so on. We know what they are. Many of us are already doing some of this, some of the time. We all need to do all of it, all the time, consistently and reliably, forever. And these are all decisions that we can make individually or by household. Beyond that, things start to get a bit more difficult. Beyond our private lives, how about tackling the carbon emissions of the places where we work? This might involve us in difficult conversations with management. If we are the management, it might involve us in difficult conversations with trustees or shareholders. If we are the trustees or shareholders, then it's time we face the fact that increased costs or reduced profits in the short term are not an argument for doing nothing. And then there's our local area, the place where we live, and the local government structures there. Have we got transition town activity already happening? If so, are we involved? If not, can we help get it started? Would it help to think of ourselves as transition Quakers or transition friends? Do we know what our local councillors are doing or not doing about sustainability? Might a few more of us be called to take our Quaker values into the public political arena and stand for election? What about our constituency MPs? We can start holding public figures to account. We can do all of this before we get anywhere near James Hansen's advised position of civil resistance, though we might also find ourselves called to that at some point. These are all the basic minimal things that every responsible citizen needs to do, whether or not they have any religious underpinning. For those of us who profess a faith, how can we countenance doing less? Some scientists are saying that it's already too late to stop runaway climate change. Others are saying that we still have a small and rapidly narrowing window in which to act. Either way, how we choose to live together will be crucial. The critical stage in the process of becoming a bystander who intervenes, turning passengers into crew, is the step of taking responsibility. So what can help and enable that? So now we come to the implications of all this for us as friends. The time is now. I've already mentioned a number of campaigns and movements to which we might appropriately lend our voice and energy. But I have in mind something much more fundamental than that. Action in our Quaker context is testimony. Faith in action, witness in the world, spirit-led ways of being, because we can do no other. The point is to bring in the kingdom or the Republic of Heaven, to engage in tikkun olam, a Hebrew phrase meaning repairing the world. For me, the central and underlying question for us as Quakers is this: are we content to be merely a support group for people on their individual spiritual journeys, or are we able to rediscover a solidarity as a people of God? The latter would, of course, include the former, but it would be something much larger and deeper, much more demanding, much more daunting and challenging, much more exciting and far-reaching. I believe we're called at this time to rediscover what this would mean. And I offer three pointers: spiritual discipline, community, and action. First, the rediscovery of the importance of spiritual discipline, or maybe discovery for the first time. This matters for its own sake, for God's sake, and as a preparation for the times ahead of us. The point of a spiritual discipline is what the Buddhists call it, practice. It's practice in the same sense as playing your scales and doing your five-finger exercises if you're a pianist. It's not exciting, mostly it's not interesting, but you do it regularly and faithfully, because without it, you can't do what you truly and deeply desire to do. Spiritual discipline is five-finger exercises for the soul. It trains the mind and the heart, the psyche and the emotions, so that when the going gets tough, when the ordinary comforts aren't available, when the demands on us seem to be greater than our capacity, we have something that we discover we can rely upon. We can't start to create that resilience when things are already difficult, any more than we could run a marathon tomorrow morning if we only started training this afternoon. What distinguishes any practice as a spiritual discipline is that it takes a particular aspect of your life and turns it constantly towards the Spirit. There are many forms of such discipline: traditional prayer and reflective reading of the Bible or other texts, mindfulness meditation, various body disciplines such as yoga, tai chi or qigong, journal writing, painting or other artwork, walking, gardening, various types of handwork undertaken mindfully, and many others. It can also be faithfully visiting an elderly neighbour or undertaking some other form of practical service. Turning any of these activities into a spiritual discipline requires first intention, that we approach them with that purpose and desire. Second, mindfulness, that we actively seek to sustain a focused and calm awareness of the present moment and turn away from distractions and scattered thoughts. And third, that we practice regularly, so the habit of mindfulness will grow and start to spread out into more and more of our lives. All such practices remove our individual egos from the center of the stage. And similarly, we, humanity, need to find ways of moving our collective ego out of the way. In addition to the three characteristics, intention, mindfulness, and regular practice, there are three helpful attitudes to establishing a life-giving spiritual discipline. The first is a version of pray as you can, not as you can't. Don't try to do something that you think you ought to do if it means setting yourself up to fail. This shouldn't be like taking out gym membership on January the 2nd and then giving up by the end of the month. Second, find something that works for your temperament and abilities and your daily pattern of life. Be realistic. And lastly, consider finding a spiritual friend, a prayer buddy, a companion for your journey, so you can encourage and uphold each other. Undertaken faithfully and sustained over time, such practices attune our inner ear to the promptings of the Spirit, so that when we're called, when our service is required, we will first of all hear the call, and secondly, we'll have the capacity to respond. This is true for each of us as individuals. It's also the case for us as local communities of friends and as a national or world Quaker community. Which brings me to my second pointer. Are we, and in what ways, willing to be community with and for each other? Being community means being willing to be accountable to each other in ways that early friends were, and in ways that we find much more challenging in our 21st century individualistic culture. Being community, being accountable, means relinquishing some of our individual freedoms. And the benefits to be gained from that can't become apparent to us until after we've taken that first step. And so to my third pointer, action. Only a demanding common task builds community, says George MacLeod, founder of the Iona community. The demanding task facing the whole of humanity is quite clear, even though our political leaders have repeatedly ducked it. But what specifically might be our task as Quakers? Here's one possibility. We know that it's imperative for both individuals and institutions to reduce their carbon emissions, and that this isn't a one-off operation, but a progressive year-on-year-on-year reduction. Groups of people who work together to achieve this are known as low-carbon communities. In most cases, a low-carbon community is a geographical group, perhaps a village, a street, a school or other institution, a business, or similar grouping. But let's consider the possibility of a dispersed low-carbon community. Of course, I have in mind Britain Yearly Meeting. What would it mean for Quakers in Britain to be truly a low-carbon community? It would require a number of steps to be taken, that each of us, as individual members of the yearly meeting, commit ourselves honestly and practically to reducing our own carbon emissions progressively by an agreed amount year on year on year. The 10-10 campaign would make that 10%. Challenging but achievable. That each of our meetings and meeting houses does the same. That our gathering together for area meetings and other functions be held in a manner that reduces the carbon emissions of all that travelling. That Woodbrook and Friends House, along with all the other Quaker-owned or Quaker-run organisations around the country, also succeed in this reduction. And that we find low-carbon methods of holding yearly meeting and meeting for sufferings. This would require from us both commitment and discipline. Our commitment would have to be not only to the carbon reduction, but also to the corporate witness of Quakers in Britain. The discipline required would encompass our carbon-related behaviour as well as our mutual accountability of being part of a larger corporate body. Friends have been most influential and effective in our witness when tested by external circumstances. when the world presents dilemmas that require the best of Quaker spiritual discipline, both individual and corporate. In Britain, this was particularly manifest in the two world wars. Friends had a clear issue to confront. It required steadfastness and faithfulness to do so, and the public stance taken drew many people to seek us out for succour, spiritual nurture, and practical support. For the generations alive now, climate change is the testing issue of our times. So this is potentially a moment when Quakers are needed. Needed to be faithful to Quaker testimony, needed to be visible, needed to be speaking out, needed to be offering leadership, needed to do the right thing in the face of pressing external circumstances. To accomplish this, we have to deepen our spiritual grounding, both alone and together, not solely for inward exploration, but also for the future of human society. A further challenge will be to find the corporate will, the rediscovery of a depth of corporate discipline, to undertake this together, wholly and fully, and not just as a matter of some individual's personal choices. But if we as friends were to find our way together, truly to be the change, we would contribute to the necessary decarbonising of British society. We would offer a beacon of leadership to others lacking a community context. And we would strengthen, deepen, and revitalise the life of our religious society. Are we ready to undertake this? We are the people alive now. We are the people who know about the problem. Who else do we imagine is going to do what needs to be done? We need a consciousness and a spirituality that creates in us joy, gratitude, determination, courage, and humility. And we can't do this without spiritual practices and ways of living that sustain us and nourish us over the very long haul. First, we need to strengthen or remake the depth of our connectedness with the rest of creation, with the whole web of life. Remaking this heart connection won't be without emotional cost. We may find ourselves needing to grieve the loss of species and habitats, the impoverishment of our environment, and our inability to save everything. The second thing we need to do is to rebuild community within our meetings, within each of our local neighbourhoods, and by integrating our meetings more deeply and broadly within the geographic communities where they happen to be located. Building community requires us all to participate, all to take responsibility. It's another version of us all being crew. Community isn't something that other people create so that I, you, we can then become parasitical on it and reap the benefits. Community only happens when everyone takes part in creating it. If we want our local Quaker meetings to be more vibrant places, then none of us can be a passenger. This view of community fits so well with our ways of organising ourselves as a religious society with no separated ministry that we might hope we'd be naturally good at this. But we need to practice, we need to get good at it. We need to make it habitual, we need to make it a vital part of our personal and corporate spirituality. The third change we have to make is to find new ways of framing the issues, to reclaim as well as declaim a radical vision for the future. Here's one example of what I mean. In the film The Age of Stupid, which some of you will have seen, about climate change, there's a short animation sequence that illustrates the idea of contraction and convergence, a dreadful abstract phrase that will never inspire anyone. The animation starts by showing the current global distribution of per capita carbon emissions, represented as differently sized people. The USA is huge, Europe quite a lot smaller, China smaller still, India is very small, and Africa is tiny. The characters then walk forward along the timeline, the smallest growing a little, the largest shrinking a lot, until at the year 2035, all the characters reach the same size, and then, as they walk forward to 2065, they all shrink at the same rate. This is a powerful image, not only of carbon reduction, but of global equity, of eco-justice. Let's reclaim a powerful political word for this: levelling. The Diggers, often referred to as the True Levellers, were the group with this genuinely radical vision. They were part of the same 17th century cauldron of religious and political ferment as gave rise to Quakerism. And their leader, Gerard Winstanley, was among London Quakers at certain times of his life. Levelling is the Quaker testimony to equality given a political edge. And fourthly, we need to act. The particular action appropriate for each of us will vary with our circumstances. And one of the significant circumstances for any of us is our life stage. To my own cohort, often tagged the post-war baby boom generation, I want to say this. By accident of birth, our generation has, in many ways, been given the best of what the modern world had to offer, and subsequent generations won't have many of those benefits. As we stand at perhaps the summit of our working lives, we stand simultaneously at the summit of industrialized society as we have known it. We benefited hugely from the massive industrial expansion that characterized the second half of the 20th century. And now we're beginning to know what that has cost the planet. Even if we escape the worst effects ourselves, our children and our grandchildren will not. So what are we going to do with our active years beyond paid employment? There's a lot of us. We changed the face of politics when we were young. We could do so again. I believe that we owe a debt of gratitude, and we have a responsibility to do what we can, not only as individuals, but also collectively. To young people just embarking on the steps into adult life, I want to say this. As you look at the options ahead of you, in terms of education, life skills, and future work, consider what will be the truly essential skills in the future that you'll need in the changing world that's coming. If you plan to go to university, either study something practical, such as engineering, medicine, or agriculture, or if you want to study for pleasure, enrichment, and interest, start preparing now to acquire the additional skills which will be the ones you'll need to support yourself and contribute to the life of your community, whatever that is. Everyone needs to learn how to grow food, how to make and mend and fix things. Between us, as extended families, networks of friends, and local groups and communities, we need to take back the hand skills that have been outsourced to mass production on the other side of the world. Also, take care to develop your soft skills: facilitation, leadership, conflict handling, and learning how to build community around you, wherever you may be. To older people, perhaps feeling that you're starting to move beyond an active exterior life, remember that you have skills and knowledge that urgently need to be passed on to subsequent generations. Consider how you may be able to ensure that your experience does not die with you. And to everyone else, the large adult group sitting beyond, between those bookend life stages, start now to acquire these new skills and attitudes for yourselves and help ensure that your children and grandchildren realize how significant and essential they are. This applies equally, of course, to those of us who don't have our own biological children and grandchildren. Just as we're all crew, we are all the parents and grandparents of humanity's next generations. We're all the ancestors of tomorrow. This picture, known as the pale blue dot, was taken in 1990 by the spacecraft Voyager 1. As it was about to leave the solar system forever, its camera was turned round to take this picture of Earth across a vast, vast expanse of space, roughly 4 billion miles. This image, reconstructed electronically from pixels, shows a tiny distant speck in a black space streaked by faintly coloured bands, which are rays of light from the sun. Carl Sagan said of this image, "Look again at that dot. That's here, that's home, that's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. This is it. This is home. This is Earth. And it's the only one we have. Seeing again the blue marble, the whole disk of Earth, we know that one planet living isn't just a nice campaigning slogan. We either achieve one planet living or we all perish. And this isn't only about the choices that each individual I must make. It's also about us as the gathered body of Quakers, as the Religious Society of Friends in Britain and around the world. It's also about us as a people of God, as a people of faith, alongside all other peoples of faith. It's also about us as the human community, all of us together, all of us part of the community of all living beings here on the earth.